So let's move on to item four, which is asset class education, as it's listed. This is a presentation item from Verus. Mr. Whalen, good morning.
Good morning.
And the floor is yours on educating us on asset classes. I'm sorry, Tim, are you kicking this off?
I can briefly. Just a quick update for the trustees. This is the point in the asset liability modeling process where we start to get serious about taking a look at individual asset mixes. That's going to be coming up at the next, at the second board meeting in May. So in advance of that, we've worked with Verus to identify a couple of asset classes and a couple of implementation strategies we think would be worth considering. So this is a chance to for the board to get educated about a couple new asset classes, get educated about a couple new implementation strategies, and give some feedback on do these make sense to take a look at these in the possible asset mixes come back in a month, or do you have strong feelings pro or con? So let's just get you educated and see if there's buy-in to take a look at these as options coming up in the next board meeting.
All right. Thank you. Any questions of Tim before we turn it over to Scott? Good morning, Samson. Hearing none. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks very much. So just to add on to Tim's comments, this is all about the asset liability study that we've got coming up next month. It's sort of prep work and work along the lines of everything that we've been doing that included the risk tolerance assessment interviews that we did over the last month. I really want to thank you guys for the time that you put into that. This is asset class education. Trying to get some feedback from you guys. So if you have any strong views, pro or con, relative to what I present today, please feel free to share them. And we'll take that into consideration as we continue with the asset modeling in the run-up to the presentation of the asset liability study next month. So I'll take you to the table of contents and just kind of give you a... the tech is not working. Oh, there we go. As we bring up the presentation. Perfect. Taking you to the table of contents. So talk a little bit about session objectives, what we're trying to do today. We've covered those. I'll review the asset liability process just really briefly to show you where we are in the level of work that we've been doing over the past couple of months and into the next month, where we're really starting to ramp things up. Going to provide an overview or a backdrop of the market environment, where we are today, and what's sort of leading to the changes that we're thinking about in the portfolio in terms of asset classes and implementation strategies. And then we'll jump into those. We'll talk about the asset classes that we're thinking about, just kind of a high level overview to give you some awareness, some understanding, and then those implementation considerations that we're talking about. So process, market backdrop, and then digging into the actual things that we're thinking about. Moving to the asset liability review. It doesn't seem to be working. Can I just ask you to advance the slides? Okay. So let's move to slide five. And so the asset liability study objectives, this is a bit of a refresher for you guys. The last time we did it was 4 years ago in 2020. Is it operator error? Probably. Indeed. Power is important. This is really all about taking a look at the asset allocation, but as we look at it every 4 or 5 years, we look at it also through a liability framework. So it's not just what are the assets doing by themselves. It's how are the assets working in relative to the liabilities, and what does that mean in terms of the important metrics that you guys look at, the funded ratio, contributions as a percent of pay, to really give you an idea of what you can expect from the plan and how the plan assets interact with the plan liabilities. So it gives you an opportunity to really look at the enterprise risk tolerance that the board sets, and then taking that and applying it to the asset allocation framework to make sure that we have a program that's lined up with your risk tolerance, that is meeting the investment objectives that you guys have set out. So in terms of where we are in the process, we've done the enterprise risk tolerance assessment. Keep in mind that is both ability and willingness. Willingness is the interviews that we went through, and we got a lot of really good feedback from y'all that we're sort of synthesizing, and we'll be sharing our findings back with the board. And then ability is the ability of the plan sponsors to accommodate risk, right? If you have a healthy plan sponsor, you can choose to take on more risk because you've got sort of this rich uncle that can protect you in troubled times. So we're through that process, and then we're sort of right in the middle of the modeling, both asset liability modeling. We've gotten all the information that we need from the actuary, and we're conducting the liquidity modeling at the same time to ensure that you guys have the liquidity to accommodate the illiquid assets in your portfolio, in the functionally focused portfolio framework. And then coming out of that, we'll identify and develop recommendations, and we'll bring it back to the board at the next meeting. So shifting gears a little bit, let's talk about the macroeconomic backdrop. And clearly, things have changed, right? You can just tell by the line and the text boxes. So we had low interest rates really since the global financial crisis, and then going into COVID, interest rates went even lower. And then we had the massive monetary and fiscal stimulus that prompted inflation. We had considerations that inflation was transitory, and then a pivot on that, which has really led to the current rate environment that's jacked rates up. And you can see that, you know, not only from clearly from the line on the chart, but the table below. You just look at the last three deep evaluations that we did, the beginning of putting the functionally focused portfolio in place back in 2015, 2016, and then through the last asset liability study we did in 2020. And you just look at the table and you see the big difference of where we were then to where we are today. Look at, for example, the Fed funds rate targets at the top of the page, just shifting your eyes from left to right. And then one real interesting point of this chart is if you look at the difference between equity expectations, the 10-year global equity capital market assumption, fairly stable, rising up and down based on current conditions at the time. But then you look at the rates relative to that and what you could get from fixed income relative to what you were expecting with equity. That gap has narrowed considerably. Just look at the two columns on the right and the two bottom rows. Short-term credit versus equities in 2020 and short-term credit versus equities today. So a lot more juice is coming from fixed income rates and credit in particular, and those are driving some of the things that we're bringing to you today. So jumping in now to asset allocation, we've got three areas that we're going to look at: multi-sector credit, so playing off of that credit theme. Real estate debt, also fixed income asset class in an area where you've typically gotten equity risk exposure in real estate. And then the last one being infrastructure. And you actually have an allocation to infrastructure in your strategic asset allocation that has not been implemented. And so we thought it was a good idea to kind of bring infrastructure back in front of you and refresh you on what infrastructure is and what it does for the portfolio. So starting with multi-sector credit on slide 11, just talking about what it is. So it's clearly a credit strategy, right? And bringing credit risk into the portfolio across several different sleeves of credit. And you can see those sleeves on the bottom of the page. Structured credit, think mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, anything that has sort of a contractual fixed income payment that's been packaged up and cut into slices and put out into the investment market. IG investment grade corporate credit. Those are just investment grade bonds to companies that trade daily on securities exchanges or in securities markets. And then high yield bonds, bank loans, and CLOs. Those are higher risk credit instruments that either have fixed or variable rates to them, and they act a little bit differently whether they have fixed rates or variable rates. You think of bank loans as a variable rate instrument where the rate adjusts depending where market rates are. And then EMD or emerging market debt, another, you know, sort of higher risk credit exposure where you're just lending to governments and companies in emerging markets. So the umbrella over the top, the multi-sector credit umbrella, just allows a manager to pick and choose where they want to be across that credit complex. And we've found it to be an attractive way to get credit exposure. Rather than having separate sleeves in your asset allocation, you have a overarching credit sleeve and allow a manager to look for opportunities where they think the best value is.
Question from the big picture standpoint, and maybe this is a question for Tim, who's managing the multi-sector credit exposure that's identified here on slide 11? Is this going to be in-house? Is this Stepstone? Who ideally would manage this?
It's a great question. So I think what we're envisioning here is a manager who can make the call across this credit spectrum. And it's got a more flexible mandate.
Yeah.
So if you think about what's in our portfolio today, we have certainly private credit, which is going to be most closely associated with the bank loan category there, but obviously privately negotiated. We have high yield debt, although it's very small. But the ability to allocate across on a flexible basis, we really don't have managers who have that broader mandate. So this is taking a look and saying, within the public market sector, does it make sense to find managers who have a skill set of being able to do these sector rotations and make that call? And so that would be, we'd be looking for managers that obviously have expertise in each one of the underlying segments, but who also have a demonstrated track record of being able to allocate effectively across those over time.
And maybe just to jump in on that, so you asked who would be managing it, you asked internal or Stepstone, so it would be neither one of those, right? Currently in your portfolio, Stepstone manages your private credit allocation, and this would be a new manager that manages public across public credit sleeves. So you have some of that in your portfolio today, dedicated sleeves of the lower level blue boxes, but we would hire a new manager that could go across all of those blue boxes. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
On the couple of slides next, we're showing the benefits of this and how this can add to the portfolio. So here we've got sort of all the components. You've got your leveraged loans with the green line, or your bank loans with the green line, the variable rate stuff. You've got with the black line, you've got your emerging market debt, and with the orange line, you've got high yield corporate credit, and then the blue line is active management of all the different sleeves, and you can see how the diversification and the ability to rotate across sectors sort of mutes volatility. It's neither the highest nor the lowest. It kind of tracks somewhere in the middle, which is not unexpected given that, you know, it's kind of a mix of all of them. And so you have that muted volatility, which then on the next page leads to higher risk-adjusted returns. And here it's sort of a similar chart tracking the different components and then the combination of the above through a median active manager in the space that shows how you're getting a better Sharpe ratio which is just returns over risk, excess returns over risk, a better Sharpe ratio, more efficient portfolio management. So those are just, that's sort of a high level introduction to the space. Not only is it sort of an asset class addition, but also sort of an implementation structure change, right? You could have all of these components in your portfolio as standalone sleeves, but giving somebody the ability to rotate through them seems like it's really a benefit. It's something that our capital markets research folks and our fixed income analysts are really attracted to.
So from a percentage of the portfolio in credit, is there a proposed or rough proportion size of this investment relative to what we have in private credit now?
Would you like to respond to that, or you want me to take a shot?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So that's the work that we're doing now, and in fact, we're right in the middle of that. We sent over a worksheet for Tim and his team to take a look at to start putting together asset mixes that we're going to run through our modeling. We'll add our own suggestions to that, and we're right in the middle of that. But I can see anywhere from, 10 to 15% of the portfolio, maybe that range isn't broad enough as we're exploring this stuff, but 10 to 15% of the portfolio in credit, and then some portion of that in multi-sector.
Thanks.
Okay, so I'll pause there before moving into real estate debt to see if there are any additional questions. And yes.
So if we move 10 to 15% into credit, then we've got to take that from elsewhere. So that's part of the modeling study that you're doing now to see. And that modeling study will kind of analyze where we're at now without change.
Yes, 100%.
And then how these proposals will impact that.
Yep. And the where we are now is, it's sort of the starting point, right? And it's a good default starting point to say, is there any reason why we should make any changes, right? It's like we have to have compelling reasons to move away from where we are now, which is a good, successful investment strategy. So these are things that we're thinking about that may provide that compelling reason. But if not, we'll come back and say, hey, there's really no reason to change.
And you anticipate in the second meeting in May that we'll be going over all of this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, so the next idea.
Actually, I had one follow on because I want to make sure I'm understanding the percentages correctly. And I didn't get a chance to check it, so I could have done that. Is the current allocation to private credit roughly 8% of the portfolio?
Yeah, I think we're closer to 10.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's being socialized is probably adding a 5% additional allocation into the credit space.
So this would be different than private credit, right? You think of your private credit allocation is separate from what we're talking about here, which is really public credit. There might be some private credit in the mix in a multi-sector allocation manager, but think about the two as separate. You got private credit,
right?
And then you got this piece, which we're talking about, of 10 to 15% on top of that. And kind of getting back to Dr. McDonald's point is that would likely come from, it would come from all different parts of the portfolio just to try and make it a more efficient portfolio. But a fair chunk of it may come from equity, given that difference between credit and equity has really shrunk. So it's an opportunity to add a different kind of risk and diversify the portfolio further to increase portfolio efficiency, increase returns in line with your risk tolerance.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, I had a conversation with somebody the other day and they were asking me about the you know, the basic construction of the portfolio, and I gave the credit number, and it was the discussion was 20 years ago that would have never been, and I said, yeah, you're right, things have really changed. So, I understand where we are, but I'm thinking that 5% is to the point made earlier is coming from somewhere. So it kind of surprises me that we might think it would come from private equity, since that's been a high performer for us.
Yeah, right? I don't think it would come from private equity.
Okay, I thought that's what was said. Public equity.
Public equity, yeah. Okay. If you think about credit fundamentally is rate risk and business risk combined. So it's, rate risk would be treasuries and that sort of thing. Business risk is, the going concern of a business, meaning that can be equity or debt. So when we're talking about credit, it's the combination of those two. And we're looking at this and saying 4 years ago, right in the midst of the early COVID wave, rates were still super low. You weren't getting paid in fixed income. You weren't getting paid in credit. So if we're going to have business risk, let's take that in the equity side. And that's been our position really for the past decade. Now with rates up, are you getting a little bit more safety with the business risk, getting it through the flexible public credit mandate like this versus the public equity markets? And that's really the tension that's in play right now that hasn't been in play for really since the GFC, where the rates have just been so low that it hasn't been competitive to take business risk in credit. You can take rate risk, but it hasn't been competitive to take business risk there. Now that spread is narrow enough, you're like, oh, okay, well, let's take a look at some options here, and maybe we can get some of that business risk with lower volatility. And that, I think that's kind of why Verus is guiding towards socializing this asset class today.
Okay, thanks.
So that would mean for like 25% of our portfolio would be credit.
So I understand that there's a... I understand that it makes sense to sort of fixate on the percentage numbers, but we're far away from the recommendation of percentages. I've just thrown potential percentage ranges out there.
I just say that because it'd be a big shift, like was mentioned. But
yeah, and we're not talking about a huge shift, right?
So okay.
it could add, let's just say, 5 to 20%. To the credit bucket relative to where you are today.
Okay. Would it be possible to get some kind of estimate on the income produced by that if we shift 10 to 15% additional allocation to the credit vehicles you're talking about, because you think in the growth portfolio, you think about capital appreciation, all that stuff. But I think it can be easy to forget about. Well, may not the price of the individual unit may not jump up, but it's generating income.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah. And so that might be helpful to add perspective. Like we do this, it's going to supply so many millions of dollars that will help pay.
You bet.
Benefits.
You bet. Any other thoughts on the credit?
On to real estate.
So real estate debt, following a similar theme.
I did have another question. I'm sorry. So it's great that fixed income rates are where they're at now, and we feel that that's actually fairly sticky because there's this talk about the Fed's lowering rates and so forth, which would impact fixed. Well, and maybe you can talk about that more. How is the fluctuation in Fed rate decisions could potentially impact this and the income generated from it? And looking forward, let's say the Fed's drop rates in half from where they're at, and if we're thinking about that, then is this, well, we'll revisit all of this. If we decide to go with this, we'll revisit it and 4 to 5 years and see where rates are doing now, or sooner if rates really fall again.
Yeah, so we think we're in a higher for longer rate regime. That's just our capital market team's views. And not going to get back to the long cyclical regime we were in for a while with rates near zero effectively, right? So we've sort of normalized. We think that we're going to stabilize at higher for longer. The Fed likely will pull rates back down at some point. Not going to go back down to zero until, you know, the next global financial crisis or global pandemic. Pick your global, you know, disaster. But just a more stable rate environment off the zero floor that we were at leads to more attractive fixed income asset opportunities. When rates begin to pull back down as the Fed decreases rates, that also will be a good environment for fixed income securities, right? As rates drop, your higher earning fixed income assets become more attractive and the value goes up. With floating rate, which is a fair chunk of this, that would be a headwind, but again, not going back down to the zero plus rate environment that we were in for a while after the global financial crisis and then after the global pandemic. So sort of a stable, more attractive environment for fixed income instruments relative to equity moving forward. Okay, so real estate debt. Again, a similar theme here, moving from equity to debt. So real estate equity you've had in your portfolio forever, both in an open-end and a closed-end format. That is sort of more liquid and less liquid along the liquidity spectrum. And thinking about just adding debt to that construct. And this is more attractive for a couple of reasons. One is the rate environment that we talked about. Two is because of the current market environment. And that current market environment is driven by a couple of things. One is there is this supply-demand imbalance where the supply of debt to real estate opportunities is being constricted because of the constraints on regional banks and their just ability to lend into this market. And so there's an opportunity for private investors like yourselves to come in and fill that gap and get attractive rates. So sort of a structural opportunity. And then also the market opportunity where the real estate market is really hungry for additional debt financing. There's this sort of wave of maturities coming due in the next, you know, 1 to 3 years, 1 to 5 years, where refinancings will need to happen. And because of that restricted supply, that demand has got to be met somewhere. So kind of a market opportunity in addition to the rate environment that's causing debt to be more attractive than equity.
So just so that I'm clear on this particular asset class, we're already in the real estate debt allocation, aren't we? I mean, isn't that what Torchlight does?
It's what Torchlight does, but we're looking at this on a more dedicated basis. So Torchlight was unique in that it kind of sits in between, from our standpoint, real estate, private debt, and fixed income. And it was always kind of treated as this is a very unique strategy. I think this is a little bit of a broadening. And while Torchlight pursues that in the private side, this would probably be a little bit more towards the public market side of being able to acquire debt, issue debt, and influence through more the listed side, not necessarily exclusively, but more the listed side, versus what we've done in the past has been through the private side.
So this is securitized debt?
Yeah. Asset backed by real estate.
Okay. Interesting.
Okay, so if you think about what real estate debt does, and I'll just cover this briefly and allow you to answer questions. If you think about what real estate does, it's providing financing to different different real estate projects across the spectrum of development, core buildings, both commercial and residential, and value add opportunities where you come in and you want to restructure a debt offering, or you want to enhance a building that's already existing. So similar to real estate equity, you have sort of core, core plus, value add, and opportunistic. Real estate debt exists in that spectrum as well. The advantages to real estate debt is, and I'll turn to the pros and cons page, it provides that stable income and reduces fluctuation that's caused by, you know, just market volatility. It lowers the risk relative to equity in the portfolio. The downsides are you don't have that equity upside. So it's really a trade-off similar to corporate debt and equity. It's really a trade-off between risk and return, with the debt providing more stability, more income, and less equity upside. And then lastly, we talked a little bit about this on the outlook. So this is being driven by supply-demand imbalance. And then the potential risks are rising rates, and rising rates are going to impact your fixed income instrument across the board. Real estate debt is no exception. Rising rates are is a headwind for a fixed income instrument. And then loan defaults on the horizon. So loan defaults provide opportunities in terms of being able to fund workouts or put in new capital into a deal, but it also could reduce the supply just because there's fewer transactions and there won't be as much supply in the market. So a couple of risks there are is interest rate risk, and then the on the credit side with loan defaults. And I'll pause there for any questions.
So I think it was this morning, it might have been last night, I was reading about the building in mid-market in San Francisco, and I realize San Francisco has maybe been plagued more than other core markets, but purchase price was $95 million, and the close on it was $9.5 million. So 90% drop in value in mid-market in San Francisco.
Office.
Reported yesterday or today, I can't recall.
That was mid-market office.
Right. So yeah. So it just in general, explain me that risk. So the fallout, we've talked about this for a long time, right? All during COVID, you know, that there's this storm that's sitting offshore waiting, right?
Which is all, train wreck, yeah.
All the people like me that are no longer working daily in an office, right? And renting space on a traditional basis. So are we at the beginning of that, or are we in the middle of that? And do we know enough about how that's going to shake out? And does that affect this type of investment?
So it would. It's a small. Well, I shouldn't say small. It is a segment of the investment opportunity. But you think about office, where it's a disaster that's playing out right now. And you asked a number of questions in there, right? So where are we in that cycle? And you talk to different real estate managers, and they'll say, you know, we're maybe halfway to three quarters of the way through that. I'm a little less sanguine on that, and I think that we're probably in the first half, maybe the fourth inning of that, relative to, and not the seventh inning. So it's going to be playing out over years. The valuation changes may happen more quickly than that, but then working through the inventory of unused properties is going to play out over years. And then, you know, so we're and then you asked how big a piece of that is that relative to the broader real estate market. So office is one component of commercial real estate, right? So you've got office, you've got residential or multifamily residential, you've got industrial, and you've got retail as the four main food groups. Office is a component of that. If you think about the standard benchmark we use in office right now, which is the Odyssey fund benchmark, that went from 30% office It was made up of 30% office, and now it's down to 17%. So that devaluation has begun to happen, but that gives you a sense of how big a segment it is of the overall commercial real estate market. And then you've got, you know, obviously if you're talking about residential mortgage-backed securities as part of this, that's a much broader opportunity set as well. So, and then even within office, one more point on that is that you talked about that 90% valuation drop. Somebody has got to come in and fund that $9.5 million. And so there's an opportunity right there to come in at a completely reset valuation point and get good money on a debt instrument for the new deals that are happening today. So you wouldn't want to buy, you know, old paper that's written on that $95 million property. That needs to be written down, but new opportunities are coming to the market at very attractive pricing. We hope.
But the premise being that in an uncertain environment, does it make sense to trade out of the equity side or to reduce our equity exposure to real estate and have some more protection in there? If you do take a property through a restructuring, obviously the creditor is driving that, not the equity owner. The equity owner is reduced or wiped out. And so does it make sense to step up in, you know, senior portion of the capital stack and being able to have more control? I think where we've seen real estate debt in our portfolio to date, it's been like Torchlight and Oaktree. They'll buy the debt in order to affect an outcome and become the equity owner. So it's really debt to become the equity owner. That's a component of this, but I think, you know, there's a little bit broader segment that we haven't explored historically, particularly in the more liquid portions of this market, that may not have as much downside, may not have as much upside either. But given, you know, to your point on where are we in the real estate cycle, and that's so murky right now, we've seen retail recover, shockingly enough. Multifamily is in the middle. Industrial has been very strong. There's some question marks as to what that looks like going forward in office. I suspect 5 years from now we might be having a similar conversation to what we're having today in terms of uncertainty around that space. Given that market environment, you know, are there other ways of approaching this asset class that make more sense given today's starting point? And that's what leads to, you know, does real estate debt, does the board want to take a look at this on a dedicated basis? That's the question here.
Okay, that's helpful, thank you.
And similar to multi-sector credit, our research folks are looking at real estate debt as an attractive way to diversify risk in the real estate portfolio. Okay, so infrastructure, as I mentioned, you have an infrastructure allocation currently that is yet to be funded. Potentially looking at funding that through this next cycle, and so Tim thought that a refresher on infrastructure was warranted. So what is infrastructure? Just very basically, infrastructure is, it's the facilities that really drive economic activity in a society. So think of roads, tunnels, bridges, power plants, wastewater facilities, everything that sort of a complex society needs to operate. Again, similar to real estate, you have a spectrum of risk and return from core to sort of core plus, value add, and opportunistic. If you think about core and core plus, it's really those things that are in place, sort of again similar to real estate, in place that are that's earning income, pretty stable assets. There's not a lot of upside potential for growth. You know, think toll roads, think regulated contractual provision of service like utilities and wastewater facilities. And then you start moving into value add, and it's more things where there's opportunity to come in and make improvements, and then you think of opportunistic, and that's sort of building stuff up from the ground up, maybe not just in the U.S. or other developed nations, but maybe moving into the emerging markets. So you, I sort of mentioned this on the previous slide, but you think about these things in terms of brownfield or greenfield across that economic spectrum. Brownfield being things that are already in the ground where maybe you can have an opportunity to improve the income that's coming in. Toll roads, for example, if you have a toll road that's operated inefficiently, you can come in and manage that to a better outcome, increasing the quality and then increasing the tolls and the income. Greenfield, more speculative, things that need to be built from the ground up. And then there's different ways that you can get involved in this, listed, unlisted, and direct. Direct is not something a board like you guys would ever do, go and you know, build a solar power generation plant, for example. But you can get involved in that opportunity with a fund that has an interest in that, and then which would be unlisted. And then listed is, you know, sort of similar to a REIT. You can invest in listed companies where you can daily trade them that are involved in infrastructure investments. That, like a REIT, would come with, you know, market volatility that is more like a stock than, say, an open-end infrastructure fund that is listed, that's valued quarterly, provides some stability, but also has some liquidity disadvantages.
Comment and a question for you.
Yeah.
The comment, brownfield, in my other life, that's a term of art that generally refers to the development of formerly contaminated properties. There's a lot of brownfield development in the Greater Bay Area, for example. I don't know if in the investment side that has a different meaning. Apparently it may. But I think the commonly understood the meaning of that
derogatory
term is what I described. Yeah. So when I read this, my reaction was, well, why in the hell would we want to go, you know, all in on taking on contaminated property risk in terms of development? So I'm assuming that's not the case that...
Yeah. No, thanks for that clarification. So brownfield and infrastructure just means something that's already in the ground that you're going to come in and either operate or make improvements to.
Yeah, so, you know, we can talk about it offline, but I'm just telling you, in a greater segment away from here, that term has a very different meaning, or that word has a very different meaning.
We will avoid using the term brownfield in the future.
And the other, or the comment I had, or the, I guess the question is the greenfield piece of this, does that carry entitlement risk? It seems like it does.
So I would think that entitlement risk would be across the spectrum of any property that you go in and invest in, particularly in development opportunities. So I think the answer is yes, but I haven't seen entitlement risk come up as a big risk in infrastructure investments. Do you have more specifics around that?
No. I just wanted to understand the distinction between the two,
right?
And whether that is a distinction.
Yeah, maybe I can just highlight the managers that we've recently committed to and that we're talking to currently. They are biased towards greenfield, so it is new development. They are typically coming in as scale-up capital, so the entitlement risk is either off the table or greatly reduced. There's typically contracts in place, and they need money to grow or to put up the plant, but the entitlement risk and the offtake risk are usually taken care of before this capital comes in on the private equity value add infrastructure side. So there are funds that will take the entitlement risk. As you can imagine, they'll have a couple projects that, you know, take 5 to 7 years longer than expected. That's not the profile we're looking at. It does exist, but that's not the profile we're looking at. Conversely, on existing projects, no managers we're working with will take remediation risk. So if there's a remediation challenge, that's not something they're willing to take on. And remediation challenge, from a lot of the managers I've talked to, even if the soil or the groundwater has been remediated, there's no guarantee that there's not going to be further issues that pop up in the future. So I think you're starting to see the entire industry get biased more towards the greenfield, the new development projects.
Yeah, it's nice to have some of the brownfield topic.
Thank you.
So thinking about where the value is driven in infrastructure projects, you know, it's similar to any value chain, even in the public equity market, private equity, real estate. You have, you know, you can come in and you can improve company operations, right? So I talked about that toll road where you can improve the income that's generated. You can improve the quality of the asset, multiple expansion. So, you know, this is about buying low and selling high through market market cycles, and then leverage. You know, you can apply leverage just to increase the power of the earnings of any strategy. These three things differ depending on whether you're talking core, core plus, value add, or opportunistic. But this is the way real infrastructure drives value through the investment process. And then lastly, you know, why we think this is attractive. So it comes with stable cash flows depending on where you are on the risk spectrum. Diversification. Infrastructure assets tend to move differently than most other assets, even real estate. The cycle is different just because of the type of asset that it is and the type of income that's generated. Inflation protection, similar to real estate, particularly in those core and core plus funds where you have income and essentially rents on the asset, and then long-term returns have been attractive over time, it sit sort of above the capital market line over time, driving pretty good returns for the risk that you're taking. Any other questions on infrastructure before moving on to implementation? Thank you very much. So, we're looking at the equity portfolio and thinking about different ways that we may be able to make some adjustments here to improve the outcome. And global equity is an area that you have in the portfolio today, but thinking about potentially improving that, sort of similar to multi-sector credit, to give the manager an opportunity to invest across the broad spectrum and potentially provide some allocation benefit or another lever for managers to pull to generate additional returns. So if you look at your equity performance across 1, 3, 5, and 10 years, you have domestic, international, and global in your portfolio. You can see how those have returned. You know, it's not a big investigatory leap to understand why global has done better than international. It's because U.S. has done better than everything, and you've got U.S. in a global portfolio. So you can see across here, across time periods, your domestic has done best, your global has performed better than international, and emerging markets that's not listed here as well. And then you can see the current allocation to each of these, the domestic and international sort of at market weights or near market weights, and then global, another sleeve to that, thinking about potentially increasing active global allocation. So why would we do this? This is some research that our capital markets team put together over time. So we look back 10 years, that was our observation period, and we took a look at what active managers have done. We combined U.S. passive and non-U.S. active managers and then looked at rolling three-year periods. And what we found was that combination, that typical combination of U.S. passive and non-U.S. active, outperformed relevant benchmark more than half the time, about nearly 70% of the time. And you looked at global active, where you give the manager the opportunity to move through the different regions and make asset allocation decisions, as well as security selection and industry selection decisions, and it performed better and fairly consistently over that time period, where it outperformed 80% of the time over the 10-year period.
Scott?
Yeah.
Is going back to that chart, is that net of fees or gross when you're doing the comparison?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I suspect, knowing our research guys, that they did it net of fees. but I can check on that.
Okay, yeah, because that would influence things quite a bit. I mean, with, when you're saying that this is outperforming,
yeah,
so impressively,
they, you know, and
throw fees into it.
It makes sense that they would have done it net of fees because otherwise that would have given the passive, the part that has passive in it, a big tailwind. So net of fees would have been the appropriate comparison there, but I'll confirm that. Thanks for that. And this is sort of a similar conclusion, but looking at it through a different lens, we looked at 3-year periods over the last 10 years. So you can see there, each bar represents a 3-year period, and this is the averaged annualized excess return of active global equity universe over that time period. So when you take all the active global equity managers, how did they do relative to a global equity benchmark over 3-year slices through that 10-year period? And you can see for each 3-year slice, they provided outperformance. And this also would be on a net of fee basis. So the question on the next page is sort of how do they do this, right? And is it through allocation or is it through security selection? And allocation can come in two different forms, right? You can have country allocation, you can have industry allocation, but security selection really is what's driving this. So interestingly, I mentioned that you're giving them another lever to pull. You can allow them to move across, you know, if US looks particularly attractive relative to international or emerging markets. But you can see here, security selection has really been the driving force here. And so these active global managers just have a broader opportunity set to choose from, and they can make hay with that. And so that's the last slide in this deck. We think that a global opportunity set and global active management is a good way to allow additional excess returns in your equity allocation. And from an implementation perspective, we may be coming back with a recommendation for an increase in global equity. And I'll pause there for questions.
Our current global equity, is that actively managed or passive?
Active.
Okay. So you just want to build on that?
Yes.
Okay. And then you're going to talk about the China situation?
Or? Yes.
Okay.
And I see that one of your trustees that is very interested in this topic is not here today.
Yes, Jerry couldn't be here today. I know he's going to wish he hadn't missed this, but
which is unfortunate, but yeah. we shall push ahead. So, interesting. So there's a lot of smoke here, not much fire yet, but I expect that there's a little more fire coming. And with that metaphor, I mean, a lot of people are talking about this. I've got several clients that are talking about it now. One client that has made the decision to actually move to an ex-China allocation. We're seeing it more and more in the press. And it's driven by a couple of things, right? So you've got people really concerned about the hegemonic battle between the U.S. and China for global dominance, right? Philosophically, militarily, economically, and so that's causing sort of a lot of agita amongst institutional investors, especially given what happened with Russia. Now, Russia was a very small part of any institutional investor portfolio. So when the U.S. government said, you know, you can't invest in Russia anymore, you know, it was uncomfortable, but it wasn't really a big impact. China is bigger. I'm going to show you the potential impact of China, and it's still relatively small compared to your overall portfolio. But people are getting nervous about, rising tensions, and that's just one area, right? There's also regulatory issues both in China and in the U.S. There's also, you know, sort of ethical issues with treatment of the minority Uyghur population and sort of constant observation of the population and control of the population, what they're doing in Hong Kong, obviously potential concerns over Taiwan, which comes back to the global geopolitical risk. And so there's just sort of a number of reasons why people are getting nervous about China, and we've been asked to look into this. So the, what I'm going to go through here that I've just sort of covered is the rationale, divestiture reasons, historical performance, and performance of China has not been strong through the last cycle. What an ex-China allocation would mean in terms of concentration risk, because if you take out 25% of the benchmark, obviously some of the other areas are going to be, you're going to have greater exposure there. And then what that means for your portfolio, and then implementation considerations. So I sort of walked through the divestment rationale already, talking about geopolitical, regulatory, ethical, and investment tail risk. Those are the prime areas where people have been concerned. And I would say it's mostly driven by what I'm hearing in the conversations I'm involved in. It's mostly driven by sort of geopolitical. And then if you look at the returns, these are calendar year returns of active emerging market equity managers. The two dots, one represents emerging market equity writ large, including China, and that's the black dot on the chart above. The green dot is EMX China. So when the black dot is higher, that means essentially that China's impact has been positive. When the black chart is lower, that means it's been negative. And so you can see sort of across the time period, and more recently, China's impact has been negative. So, you know, China has came out of COVID late. It had the mandatory lockdowns longer. The recovery from COVID was slower. It had the big real estate problems. It had, some governance issues where it was really hamstringing the ability for strongly performing companies to continue to perform strongly, sort of controlling management. So there have been issues in China that have caused poor performance lately. Going back longer, you can see stronger China performance. That was really when sort of the BRICS nations narrative was strong, and China was a big driver of that. China valuations remain cheap. So the question is this an opportunity to buy low, or is it a question of catching a falling knife? And, you know, we don't have an answer to that. We think that the market is a fair discounting mechanism, and so probably reflects pretty well what the go-forward opportunity is. Recently, China has been coming back as, you know, the tensions have sort of settled and institutional money is actually moving back into China despite the headwind, but that, you know, can change sort of quickly. You look at the valuations on the chart on the lower right-hand or on the right-hand portion of the page, and you can see the current P.E. ratio of 9.5% is low relative to the long-term average. So China is currently priced cheaply relative to itself and relative to other emerging markets and other markets in the world.
Scott, one question that comes up with China is the how accurate is the data that's reported? So what does a 9.5 P/E ratio really mean? Is that a true number, or that's always been kind of a question, right?
With China. So I would say that the P/E is a fair representation of the valuation metric, particularly as it changes over time. You know, you've got price, which is that's an objectively discoverable number. You've got earnings, which, you know, you can manipulate earnings, but a lot of the companies that are investable have accounting firms that where the investors say, you know, we need to see sort of international accounting standards reflected in these earnings numbers. So I would say that the price and the earnings numbers are relatively dependable compared to all the statistics that the government puts out, right? So fair question. Moving to the next
slide. So we talked about reasons why, you know, it makes sense to divest from China. A lot of them, you know, more sort of qualitative than quantitative, other than poor recent performance. But these are reasons why, you know, it may, there are sort of counterpoints to the argument, right? And one is concentration risk. So if you leave China, you see that 25% blue bar across the top represents the weight in the emerging market index, the total emerging market equity index, and then the orange bars represent the weights of the countries outside of China. So if you take China out, what are you going to be overweight to, right? And you'll be big overweight to India. Interestingly, you'll be big overweight to Taiwan. So the natural question is, well, you know, if the big concern is China invading Taiwan, moving a big chunk more into Taiwan is not really going to help us. Korea, so a lot of shifting around the Asia region. You know, it could be good, it could be bad. India's been doing really well lately. Taiwan, with the performance of its biggest contributor, TSMC, the chip manufacturer in Taiwan, strong performance. Korea, strong performance. So moving out of China, which has been a laggard, into countries that have been performing well, could be a reasonable thing, but you will be having additional concentration risk. It shifts the exposure.
It is, you know, but Apple and Foxconn both have shifted to India, right? Or shifting,
yeah,
you know, I should say. I mean, so that's like a real thing, right? That's a major set of players that have just physically decided
diversifying
that's not the venue.
Their supply chain. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
yes. Yeah. So, and then you think about this same chart, but from an industry perspective and a company perspective. So the industry shift would be much more towards technology, right? And the company shift, interestingly, TSMC currently makes up about 7.5%. That one company makes up 7.5% of the entire emerging market equity index. It's a Taiwan semiconductor company, semiconductor manufacturing company. And if you shift out of China, it makes up 11%. So there's the different concentration risks that come into the portfolio, you know, which could be a good thing or a bad thing. It's just shifting up the risk profile. And then lastly, how does it impact the portfolio? So this is sort of a graphic that to follow. If you think about a stock, bond, and other total portfolio, and this is just illustrative. So the equity portion of that portfolio, let's just say it's, you know, 50% equity. Yeah, thank you. Sorry about that. The global portfolio allocation, the makeup is 64% U.S. equities, 25% international developed, 10% emerging markets. So you're starting with a global allocation in your equity portfolio of 10% to emerging markets. And then you split up that emerging markets between China and other. China is about 26% or a quarter of the portfolio. So in a total portfolio construct, globally, you might have 2.6% in China. In your portfolio, just the way your portfolio is structured, it's just about 1%. So let's just say worst case scenario, you stick with China, U.S. government comes in, does what they did to Russia, you can't invest there anymore, your investment goes to zero, you're going to lose 1% of the portfolio. So that's sort of your ultimate downside. It doesn't make up a ton of the portfolio. Our view on this is, you know, we are not table pounding in either direction. We think that there's reasonable arguments to stay in. We think that there are very real reasonable arguments to move out. If you were to move out, we'd look for active managers that do EMX China. And there are more and more of those coming online all the time. And there are, you know, a year ago, we said, you know, moving out of China, you don't really have a lot of opportunity to get good, high-quality active manager exposure. But there are good, high-quality active managers out there that are paying attention to this and saying, okay, well, this is the way the market's moving. we should probably come to market with a strategy, and all of them are willing to talk about it. So you could go one way or the other.
So on that point, is your plan to come back with a recommendation when we consider this in May about what we ought to do?
No. And I say that sort of flippantly, but it's we don't have a position on this. We think that you could go one way or the other, and it's really at the board's discretion. And some boards are saying, yep, we want to get out. And some boards are saying, no, this is a small part of the portfolio, and we're going to spend our mind share elsewhere. So
It's not a jump ball, though. I mean, from the standpoint, this is a pretty significant decision in many respects. So I at least for me,
So if you're,
I'm looking for a recommendation.
If you're going to hold my feet to the fire, I'll make a recommendation today that I don't think you should move because of the because from our perspective is it is a jump ball, but there's inertia and cost to moving. So I think I'd come down on that side for that reason.
That's very helpful. It's good to know where your head's at on it. That's important to us, to me. Okay.
Well, one.
Yeah. Right. It is difficult because if we're going to do emerging markets, it's such a large portion of that index. And some of that comes down to the way MSCI has constructed that index and, you know, the way they calculate the free float there. But I think you have to take a look at this and say, if you're comfortable with emerging markets risk, you are signing off that the methodology for building the universe makes sense. These are the types of companies we want to be invested in. We recognize that these are not Western companies, but they're on a typically on a path towards more Westernized accounting and standards, but you are taking more operational risk. You are taking more, you are farther away from the I guess the on-the-ground operations and observing that. So there is that distance element there. So I'd say if the board is comfortable with emerging markets, my preference at this point would be to use a broader definition there. I think, because a lot of the arguments against China do tongue down to qualitative things, if we had a overarching view of there's a human rights record that we maintain before we invest in a country, that's a different thing. But this is just a more of an existential question about where does China fit in the global economy. We understand that they are, a large trading partner and a large rival simultaneously, and that creates a difficult starting position. But if we take a look at this and say, who's providing the economic growth engine, even though they hasn't been there in their financial markets, they're still a very large economy. So I'd say at this point, while the comfort level is not in the green, it's in the yellow, not the red.
Now, one option I think would be to leave what we have where it is and then new money go into a ex-China type of strategy with respect to emerging markets. That's another thing to consider.
It could be. I mean, I think, we're seeing the industry try to meet a need right now in terms of the ex-China strategies. It's most of these are typically 3 years or less in duration. Typically, these are a carve-out of an existing strategy. They look good right now because China had a difficult 2021 and a difficult 2023. So if you were overweight to Taiwan and to TSMC, which has been on a tear, that looks great. If you were overweight to India, who has been doing big infrastructure pushes and having a lot of capital outlays, that looks really good right now. The question really comes down to, over the next decade, are we comfortable taking a material deviation away from the global kind of opportunity set in our emerging markets allocation? That's a more difficult conversation. And that's why we have these, you don't get the warm fuzzies, right? But it's going to be, can we sign off on emerging markets risk? If yes, my preference is for a broader definition of emerging markets. And I understand it is a, you know, an uncomfortable conversation, but that's, you know, from a governance perspective, we think it's important that the board be fully informed.
Yeah.
If there is a difference of opinion, wanting to go in a different direction, happy to do that. I think the opportunity set of EMX China is getting more robust. I think it's still a smaller opportunity set today in terms of the managers who do it well.
Well, then another important piece of information would be the economic outlook for China, right? If it's slumping right now, but going forward, are there high hopes? And we've seen some change in diplomatic outreach and so forth, and some improvements, right, between China and the U.S. and so forth. So maybe that's a sign that going forward, the jets will be cooled a little bit with respect to geopolitical tensions. But I mean, who knows? But I mean, if there's a real sense of economic output predictions for China going forward, like we really think they're going to take off, then, you know, then that's a returns issue. That.
So just a data point on that. We have two emerging markets managers. Both are actively managed. Both are underweight China, materially so. They recognize the challenges for, you know, short-term economic growth there. They recognize that there's been the pressure, and so they're both running underweight positions, which is why you see us at 1% in China and not a higher number there.
Nothing like the fear of missing out, right?
But let's recognize it is 1% of the portfolio.
Right.
It's a big
conversation,
but it's 1% of the portfolio.
That's an important thing to keep in mind in terms of the scale.
So just sort of wrapping up, I'll look for any additional feedback on any of the topics that we've discussed. We ended with China, but we'll be looking hard over the next couple of 3 weeks at including multi-sector credit, real estate debt, and infrastructure in the strategic asset allocation. And then from an implementation framework, which is the second step following the asset liability review, global equity and emerging markets ex-China. Any additional thoughts, comments?
All right.
Questions?
Any additional thoughts or comments?
Just a quickie here for mainly for Tim, but I think in line with some of the prior comments about the opportunity set, I think it does make sense to give staff and the program as much opportunity set as possible. And you know, whether you all choose or your active managers choose on country allocation, I think kind of the freedom to choose there opens the plan up to kind of a higher risk return, higher return possibility. And kind of in that context, I'm really glad we're revisiting the strategic asset allocation now, given the much changed yield environment. And so things like multi-sector credit or even securitized credit, you know, kind of makes sense in place of things like maybe risk parity or you know, other pieces of the portfolio that might be swapped out. Just a general question, though. Given kind of the significant portion of the plan in the liquidity bucket, right, the 17%, 20%-ish of the plan, even with the kind of front-end yield environment, that's really additive. How constraining is it to have that much of the plan in kind of short-duration fixed income when you know, you're talking about these other possible opportunities?
I mean, it's a material portion. I'd say it's much less constraining than it was 4 or 10 years ago. I mean, we're getting a 5% yield on that today versus, you know, closer to 1-1.5% even just a few years ago. So I think in this rate environment, the opportunity cost is lessened. But I do think whenever we do the asset liability studies, we typically take a look and say, like, here's your starting point of three. You know, we had the starting point of 4 years of benefit payments. Showed the board options for 2 and 3. The board moved to 3 years in 2020. I think that, you know, it's timely to take a look at that again. Here's options of, you know, different durations. Do you want to pick a different duration? So that'll be part of what Verus does when they come back.
Yeah, thanks. And I think when we see those numbers and we're talking about years or kind of the hedging period and a number of years, it would be nice to see it on a net basis also, instead of just gross, assuming the sponsor contributions are zero. just if we could also see, you know, assuming that they make their contributions, how many years of hedging that would be.
I think I provided that feedback to Verus 2 days ago already. So, yeah, we want to take a look at that as well.
All right, any other questions for Tim or Scott? Not seeing any, so thank you. Thank you both. Very interesting, and thank you for the recommendation.
Thanks for your patience.
Yeah, no, it's you know, if these things were easy, everybody would do them, right? So.